This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the phone on the show.
This is Danny and Gallant. It's that time we bring in our friend Michael Bumpus for Blue 42.
Here we go. This is Coors Light's Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, G, U-corner, halfback, flat, on two. Ready, right!
Blue 42 is brought to you by Coors Light. The mountains turn blue at 42 degrees.
Blue 42!
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42! Blue 42!
Morning, Bump. How are you now?
Good morning, fellas. I'm doing well. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing pretty well, Bump. It's been a little bit of an odd morning. I got up in arms about baseball people picking nits in the plan to return. Paul crossed his eyes, couldn't get him uncrossed. It's been a little bit odd, I'll be honest.
And I called for Ben Roethlisberger to be suspended for trying to cut his hair. That was fun.
Yeah. Paul felt that the violation of social distancing protocol in Pittsburgh should cause. I thought he did us all. It was a national service that he groomed himself.
He looks good though.
Please, I'm so glad he did it. I'm so glad.
It looked like he was on the Dirty Man strike from the movie where they stop any sort of bathing or personal grooming. It's just a Dirty Man strike. That's what it looked like he was on.
Good for him. If I were to do that, my wife would have some issues. So, but I'm not Ben Roethlisberger either. So maybe that makes a difference.
I would love to see Michael Bumpus with a mountain man beard and just looking as if he had trekked the wilderness for decades, perhaps. But we got question number one for you, Bump. Pete Carroll's been having some really interesting conversations with Steve Kerr on the Flying Coach podcast, but he had a very interesting answer when he was asked about an emphasis on analytics in his coaching style.
Uh-oh. I was ready for it. Then I flubbed it. Now I got it.
I'm a real victim to that now. I'm such an optimist that I kind of think that, you know, I see something that really excites me about a guy and I want to, you know, I don't have to see like him play great all the time. If I can see enough stuff, then I think I can tap into it. And I'm a little bit of a victim of that, you know, recruiting and all that, because I am maybe too optimistic about that. Basically, they pretty much are what they are, and then you develop them, you know, and you try to add too. But I faltered it.
So we'll actually get to the analytics comment a little bit later. Pete says basically here that he is sometimes a victim of seeing potential in a player. He'll see someone, he'll buy into what they could theoretically do. Do you buy that from Pete?
Yeah, you know, I think that he does do that, you know, and that's probably what makes him great, because he gives guys opportunities. If you can flash, if you can put something on film that makes him scratch his head or makes him ponder the future with you, I think that's a good thing. And I kind of like that approach. You know, I don't know what he's gonna say about the analytics part, but I like that Pete Carroll really looks at the film. And if you can do something impressive once or twice, then he's like, hey, maybe we can develop that. Maybe we can get him to hone in to being that type of player and give him an opportunity. And if you give guys like that who flash opportunities, you might strike gold every now and then. I'm thinking that's what happened with Russell Wilson. I want to say that in practice, something happened. Russell made a play. He made a move. And he's like, hold on, we might have something here. Let's give this young guy a chance. 19 years later, two Super Bowl appearances, one Super Bowl championship.
Let's go to question two here. Now we got the analytics. Here is Pete's answer to the question of whether he has kind of somebody in his ear during a game, giving him statistics, giving him the numbers on the choices that he's facing in front of him.
No, I don't have him on the headphones with me, but I'm prepared throughout the time to look for the opportunities and the situations. And my guy that I lean on the most, Brian Ayers, he'll get to me a message if I need it during the game, what's going on, if the numbers or the stats are something that are important to us. But we've basically done the work ahead of time so that the game can flow and we're not back and forth with it.
Right.
Because I pretty much know how we want to go. We want to be as aggressive as we can. We want to go for it whenever the opportunity is. You're right, Dave. Particularly back in the days at SC when we were really good, we'd go for it all the time because you guys are going to make it. You know, they're going to come through. Well, the league's a little more evened out, so there's more decisions like that.
It sounds to me like he doesn't really have somebody that's giving him. He's got a general idea, and if there's a message that needs to get to him, but it's not like they're saying, hey, there's a 42% chance if you punt here that they're going to get the ball back and come back and score. He's relying on his gut, Bump.
Yeah, and honestly, I love that. I respect guys who are big on analytics and have that big old play sheet and have all these guys talking to them, but if you haven't prepared during the week, what are those analysts going to do? They're just going to confuse you. They're going to make you second guess yourself. I'm more of a guy as, look, go with the flow of the game. Talk to your players. What's your offensive line saying? What's your quarterback saying? What are they seeing out there? Is there a momentum shift? Analytics do not account for player errors. If someone's tired, if emotions are high, if we need a big play here. So, you know, I respect it. And that doesn't surprise me that Pete Carroll goes off of emotion. I mean, he is an emotional type dude. Not necessarily going off of emotion as a whole, but going off of his preparation for that week. You ask players to come in on a Sunday night or morning, whatever, and be ready to go. Put in all the work during the week. On Sunday, just go out there and play and have fun and react. And I think coaches should take that approach as well at some point. Now, there's going to be a point in the game where you're going to rely on analytics. But as a coach, I mean, when I was coaching, my coaching style, man, I put in my work all during the week. Now I'm just going to go with the flow. I love that, and I think that because he's done that, he's gained the trust of his players. Because when you're going off of that, you're not just going off a sheet of paper or someone in your ear telling you what you should do. Everyone's on the same page. You're communicating. You know what I mean? Everyone's moving together. So I like that approach. If I were a head coach in the NFL, that's the approach I would take, and it's worked for him thus far, so why should he change it up?
Exactly. Like, I hate to make a military comparison, but you said it exactly right. You want to be as prepared as you possibly can going into a battle, but once the battle begins, things are going to change. And I understand that having extra information is a real benefit, and I don't say stay away from analytics like some people do. But, like, to use some math here, there's 151 plays about every single football game, and every single one of those plays, there's 22 different variables. So how accurate can any of your numbers realistically be? You do have to operate with a mindset of my gut has to trump what maybe some numbers are saying in a certain situation. Because I have to know how, as you just said, Bump, the game is playing out to make an accurate decision. Because you might be playing a team that has like a terrible run defense, but for whatever reason, you just can't get it going that game. Say the Seahawks against the Packers in the playoffs, and at a certain point, you have to make a decision that is based off of the flow of the game, as opposed to the Packers having a wretched run defense and continuing to try to run the football against them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you, Paul. I mean, take, for example, maybe Russell's deep ball is not working this week, and maybe you're playing against a team that gives up the deep ball. You have to adjust. You know, maybe Russell's saying that, look, I can't roll out. Let's get away from the play action. So it's all about communicating and trusting what you've done during the week and being able to make adjustments. At some point of the game, there's a point where you throw away the script. You're like, okay, we've ran through these 10 plays that we love. They're not working. Now let's adjust and rely on what we did during the week to prepare for this moment.
Question number three. The last dance is over. It was pretty fun. And at 8:30, we're going to try and cast the Seahawks as players from that Bulls team. We all know that Russell Wilson has to be Michael Jordan. Pete Carroll has to be Phil Jackson. But when it comes to guys like a Scottie Pippen, a Dennis Rodman, Bup, we're going to charge you right now with casting members of the Seahawks to play those two. Who would you cast to play Scottie Pippen? Who would you cast to play old Dennis Rodman, which I imagine is very difficult given this current Seahawks team?
For Scottie Pippen, I would have to go, and I'm just talking about personality and leadership style. There's some things Scottie did during the documentary that I didn't agree with. I don't think this guy would do that, but it would have to be a Bobby Wagner, would be Scottie Pippen, right? I mean, I feel like he's the guy, when things are down, he's going to grab his teammate and be like, all right, let's go. you know, staying positive and just being that right-hand man. I think it has to be Bobby Wagner when it comes to Scottie Pippen. Dennis Rodman is a little tough. If we go Dennis Rodman, I'm just going to go off of just the way he dresses and the way he looks. I got to go with DK. I mean, he's got the nose earring. He's got the one earring in his ear. I saw the binky. I saw him in Leavenworth last summer, and he was dressed with a flannel and some tight jeans. And, you know, fashion-wise, he's out there a little bit. I don't think he's going to leave the team mid-season and fly to Vegas or anything like that. But just off of just physical appearance, I'm just looking at the guy. DK seems like he has a little more flash to him when it comes to his wardrobe. But if we go way back, Dennis Rodman is Marshawn Lynch for sure.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I wondered if it was Sherm, but I was like, no, Sherm's more Horace Grant. You know why? Like, he's considered the source on some unflattering portraits. Someone who's considered to leak some certain details. I think that's why Sherm gets into the Horace Grant. They kind of waved by to him in the middle of the run. I like Bobby Wagner as Pippen. I think that is, and you're right, the dissatisfaction with the contract, that part aside, but someone who's kind of understated and doesn't really get the due, because Pippen is a hell of a player. I mean, people can say all the different things. Like, that dude could defend point guards. It was unbelievable to watch what he could do at his length, and he was the perfect partner. He was the perfect partner for Michael Jordan.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to say Hunt is Steve Kerr, too. I mean, he comes in when you need him. He'll make a play every now and then. He's not going to say he's the greatest player in the world, but he's reliable for the most part. So if there is a Steve Kerr on the squad, I got to go with Hunt in that position.
That's great. That's Blue 42. It's brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light. Bump, we didn't get a chance to ask you this, but why is it that so many players tend to get in trouble in the offseason? Like, why does every year... And I really do get tired of the stories that try to point blame of like, oh my gosh, this rash of arrests. Well, there's 9,000 guys that have jobs in the NFL, or I'm sorry, 3,000 guys that have jobs in the NFL right now, 90 guys on 32 different rosters. But why do you think it happens during the offseason?
Thing. And, you know, this offseason with all that's going on with Dunbar and Baker and Latimer, a couple other guys, and every year there's always some guys get into some type of trouble. And I compared it to the other leagues, and you don't hear it as much. Guys in other leagues get in trouble. And I think it comes down to a couple of things. I think the numbers. There are 53 guys on NFL roster. I know people think these guys are superhuman. They're not supposed to make mistakes. But with 53 guys on the roster, there are more opportunities for guys to get into some type of trouble. And then I just look at just some of the upbringing of the guys. You know, like me, for example, you know, I didn't grow up poor or anything like that. I didn't grow up rich either. But, you know, I hung around some dudes who weren't on the same mission I was on. Now, I remember coming back coming back home from school and college, and guys were getting into trouble and doing things we were doing when we were in high school. And it took me a couple of years to kind of separate myself from these guys. So now you put this on an NFL guy, guys who are making a lot of money, guys who have people dependent on them. And it's almost like you don't want to leave the guys behind who helped you get to where you are today. So at some point, you're going to interact with these guys. You're going to hang out with these guys, and they're going to put you in some sticky situations. Now, if you surround yourself with people who understand who you are and what you have to lose, they kind of exclude you from those activities or whatnot. I think it comes down to having all these guys on the team and just hanging out with the guys you grew up with. Like, you don't want to leave the guys behind. You don't want to leave your cousins behind, your best friends behind. But at some point, as a professional, you have to make that decision. And I think for some guys, it takes a little longer for them to realize that look, you have a lot to lose. You're under a microscope. And going to this party or going to this function really just isn't worth it. And I hope young guys figure that out sooner than later.
He is Michael Bumpus. Bump, it's awesome to talk with you. We really appreciate you joining us, and we'll look forward to talking to you. Well, you're going to be in for me tomorrow, so everybody can look forward to that.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me, Paul. I'll see you tomorrow.
See you, Bump.
That is Michael Bumpus. Paul, we started off, and I played it in the wrong order, but the player's potential and Pete's fixation on that, I thought it was one of the more interesting it's not really an admission, but it's more like a self-scouting or an analysis that he made of himself. And it was during the Flying Coach podcast, which you, if you haven't gotten a chance to listen to, is actually, it's extraordinary. The level of dialogue and Steve Kerr and Pete Carroll talking about the different things they see in coaching. And here's Pete Carroll, and he says that he falters sometimes when it comes to measuring a guy's, looking at a guy's potential over what he actually is in that moment.
I'm a real victim to that now. I'm such an optimist that I kind of think that, you know, I see something that really excites me about a guy, and I want to, you know, I don't have to see like him play great all the time. If I can see enough stuff, then I think I can tap into it. And I'm a little bit of a victim of that, you know, in recruiting and all that, because I am maybe too optimistic about that. Basically, they pretty much are what they are, and then you develop them, you know, and you try to add too. But I falter there.
What do you take from that?
It's weird that he says he falters there, because at least in my limited observations, I don't feel like he has gone all in on some player based off of their potential. Now, I've been here a year. Maybe DK Metcalf is the exception here, but
he's one that certainly worked out, right? He's one that, and probably turned out to have a better work ethic and competitive drive than maybe they even have managed. He's been one that's worked out extremely well.
Right. And look, it's 1 year for that. We'll see about some of the other members of this draft class. I'm optimistic about this draft class, even though LJ Collier wasn't able to do a whole lot this past season. I liked what I saw from Cody Barton. I liked the limited glimpses I saw of Marquise Blair, but that last part, limited reps for Anugo Amadi, who really jumped off the screen when I saw him. Limited reps for Marquise Blair, who was laying people out, forcing Deebo Samuel fumbles. You would think that there would be a little bit more of that from Pete Carroll, and I guess I'm wondering why this past season maybe we didn't see as much of it as we, I'd imagine, have in years past.
I thought the exact same thing, was that I was, if last season was not a season in which I would say that he focused on potential at the expense of current talent. I thought that they went with veterans, and some of that was out of a fear of young guys making mistakes. And maybe those guys looked terrible in practice and were consistently screwing something up, and he was just like, we just can't take that chance. But I felt consistently that they went with safer options at the expense of upside. I thought they could have been a better defense if they played some of the younger players. If Marquise Blair plays more, I think he was better. I definitely have seen it in the past, and the two guys that jumped out to me when I heard him talking about not needing to see it all the time, but just needing to see a couple glimpses, Percy Harvin and Malik McDowell. And I think that those were two guys, and McDowell specifically, because Malik McDowell was someone that was seen as a top 10 potential pick at the end of his sophomore season. Like, that's where he was. When they do the, hey, what does next year's draft look like? When going into what turned out to be Malik McDowell's final season, like, he was considered a potential top 10 pick. That's how good. And he had a bad season. He got hurt. And I think there became a lot of questions about his work ethic. And so they got him in the second round. And it's tough to say, hey, they should have seen that coming or a warning flag, because he had a vehicle accident, right? That's not something that's foreseeable. At the same time, that was someone that they projected. That was someone that they let the belief of what he can become when we surround him with hard workers. Pete believes you can teach grit. Like, he believes that when you get guys into an environment, you can get them to elevate their level of competitiveness, fixation. And that idea is, I don't want to say it's controversial, but I've had coaches tell me, Dean Demopoulos, who was an assistant with the Sonics, it's one of my favorite quotes ever, was, look, if you have to tell a guy to run as a sophomore, you're going to tell him to run as a senior. And the upshot of it is, you can't teach hustle. Like, he either hustles or he doesn't. Like, you can make him afraid of you yelling at him, so he starts hustling, but he's never going to be that natural hustler. Like, if he doesn't do it now, he's not going to do it then. And I don't think Pete believes that. I thought LJ Collier was sort of that sense of getting, shooting for a single instead of swinging for the home run. actually thought that that was a first-round pick on a rotational defensive lineman. And I don't know how high his ceiling is. He's older. He's certainly a tough dude. Like, that's what everybody's thought, is that he's a guy that'll is absolutely going to get in there and hold his own. But he's not a fast twitch pass rusher. Like, that's the value. I thought that the ceiling on him was lower. So I actually thought that they went with sort of the working class rank and file player as opposed to trying to get a standout with that pick. So it was interesting for me to hear him say that. Have they kind of corrected in some ways? Is that why we've seen them take a step back? It was an interesting response, because I would say I've seen them bet on potential less in the past year than I felt they've previously done that.
And that's interesting. And is that because there's maybe a disconnect between John Schneider and Pete Carroll? Is that part of it? Does John Schneider see things in guys that maybe Pete isn't able to see once he finally brings them in? I wonder why that is the case, because I understand why they would want to potentially win the lottery when they're drafting someone late or bringing in someone like a Steven Sullivan, trading back into the seventh round to get him because they think that this guy has got some unbelievable potential. And it has worked out for them in the past. Obviously, it worked out with Richard Sherman. It worked out with Cam Chancellor. It's worked out with Doug Baldwin. I mean, there are a lot of players that you could point at and say, wow, look at who they had faith in and how it worked out for them. But there's also one, there's got to be another side where it's unrealistic to continue to find people in that spot. And when you continue to have faith that you are going to be able to hit a home run in every single spot, you're going to miss a lot. You're going to end up like Adam Dunn. You're going to be hitting 200 with like 70 home runs. Okay, well, that's great, but you're still hitting 200. Got to get on base, home slice.
What do you think the best approach with the draft is? Do you think it is that consistent on base, or do you think it's home run swings?
I think it's on base. You want to really? Have, look, every now and then you're going to hit a home run with one of those on base swings that you get. And I think the more players, the better. But when you take risks, you miss. And when you miss, it can hurt you. And that's not to say that the Seahawks have been going after guys early on that they're necessarily that they envision as a home run. I mean, I have a hard time buying into the idea that the Seahawks looked at LJ Collier and thought to themselves, this guy is going to be an elite pass rusher. They probably thought, this guy could be a really good starter for us for a couple of years. And, you know, that should be in first-round expectation for picks made later on. So,
I like risks, man.
Yeah.
I like risks.
You do?
Bruce Irvin, Bobby Wagner coming from a small school, Utah State in the second round, the short quarterback, Russell Wilson, the sixth round pick J.R. Sweezy that you're going to turn, or seventh round pick that you're going to turn around to play. They drafted Jeremy Lane that year out of Northwest State, which I didn't even know of. Like, they drafted it from a directional, like, that doesn't even say that it was Northwest State. Like, which state? Turns out it was Louisiana. But yeah, I kind of like the risks. I kind of like it when they, you could say, like, I'd like to roll the dice.
Oh God. We got to bring it back. You know what? We got an hour and a half left. May as well.
It's Danny and Gallant. Coming up next, we are going to talk about the Seahawks. If they were formatted to The Last Dance, if they were going to be Jordan's Bulls, who would play which role? That's ahead.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant. The Last Dance is over. They've done danced 10 hours later. The Seahawks were your 1996 to 98 Bulls. If you were going to cast them in the parts, how would that go? Because I think the inclination is certainly to put Russell as Jordan, but they're very different personalities. They're very different personalities.
Polite robo-Jordan.
Yeah. The thing with Russell is, and there's a limit because I'm not inside the meeting rooms and I don't see, but everything that I know from having covered that team and been around that team is that Russell is someone who he focuses on himself and making sure that he is as prepared as possible. And honestly, he spends more time and money on making himself as ready as possible, whether it's rehab, whether it's nutrition, all of the different things he does, as any athlete that I've ever seen. He's as regimented as Ray Allen was. He's certainly someone who it feels like he carves out every single advantage. But he's not someone who's demanding or demonstrative toward his teammates. Like, he's not someone, and that was the thing you got from Jordan, is Jordan rode his teammates. And however you want to say, like, and I don't even think he would contest that. Like, he was the guy that, hey, I'm going to pull people even if they don't want to be pulled. I'm going to push you even if you don't want to be pushed. You got no choice. If you're on a team with me, you're going to compete at my level.
We talk about leading by example. Russell Wilson actually does it, because it doesn't feel, as the way you characterized it, I feel the same way. He is not going to get into DK Metcalf's face for fumbling a ball after catching a pass. This is not how he is. Michael Jordan would have done it a little bit differently. I think Russell Wilson is going to be so prepared and so regimented, and as you said, Ray Allen-esque. Ray Allen is a great comparison. Ray Allen, there are very few players who I think put as much into just being the kind of player that they were than Ray. And I think that people look at Russ and they say, dang, I should be that. Where with Michael Jordan, it's not just that Michael Jordan did all that extra work. It's also that Michael Jordan was like, oh, Scott Burrell, you're not doing this? Huh? You little bleep. And then he would light into other players as well. And there was a little bit of fear, more fear probably than following Jordan's example. It was more, shoot, if I'm not up to Jordan's level, I'm going to be gone.
Is it possible that Pete Carroll is the Jordan personality on the team? And not in terms of how, because, man, they couldn't be more. Jordan had an edge. Jordan, as a leader, certainly used fear. Pete is not someone who uses fear. But I would say that Pete is the one whose personality dominates the team in the way that Jordan's personality dominated the Bulls. That you'd think it was Phil, but Phil Jackson, I think, is less the center force and more the guy who would try to make small adjustments and get Jordan to function or think about things a little bit differently. And he controlled the structure. He controlled what offense they were going to use. But it was Jordan's personality is what determined the shape of that team. And I think it's Pete's personality that determines the shape of the Seahawks. And maybe some of that is the difference between sports, right? A basketball coach, the football coach is the most important coach out of baseball, basketball.
100%. Yes.
And that's borne out in the salaries as well. The average NFL coaching salary last year was $6 million. The average player salary is short of $3 million. So it's borne out. It's the only sport. Baseball's wild. Baseball's average salary is like $4.3 million. And there's like three managers who make more than the average baseball player salary. And there are five guys who make less than $1 million. Lose salary. I mean, it's not even close. And basketball, it's a little closer, but the average player salary is about double, a little less than double what the average player salary is. The average coach makes
a
little
less
than half.
And they get scrapped so quickly. Like, if you got a superstar and he doesn't like said coach, even if he's a good coach, bye-bye, toodaloo.
And I do think there's something to that, that Pete's personality is the one that dominates the Seahawks. Because if you ask me who the leader of the Seahawks Super Bowl teams is, there's not a central figure in the way there was the Bulls with Jordan. And even to some respect, the Patriots, certainly the last three have been Brady. The first three, though, Brady was the central figure, but did anybody really think, I don't know if people were convinced that he was the best player on those teams, but he was seen as the leader of those teams. But it's really been Belichick. Belichick's personality is what dominates those teams, right? Like, Belichick's the one who determines those teams' personality.
Yeah, I think so. It's very level, but also it's one of those things that he just says, do your job. If you don't, you're gone. It's that simple. And that, I think, leads a lot of players to do whatever they can to make sure that they don't get on his bad side. It's different with Pete. I think you're correct in that it's his personality that does dictate the way the rest of the locker room goes. But again, like, neither Pete or Russell do the same things that Jordan does when they can't reach somebody or they feel that they're not reaching somebody. It's more of a passive-aggressive approach. It's more of an approach that I think is common in a 2020 workplace, too, where, look, if someone's not doing their job, you're not going to go over to them and hold their hand, and you're definitely not going to go over to them with a megaphone, essentially, and start yelling in their ear about the TPS reports that they're not doing.
Do you think that we'd be better? Do you think we'd get more done as a society if you could do that? Like, have we become soft because we can't yell at people in the workplace anymore? We don't get as much work done?
I suppose. I mean, for me, I hate everything I do, and I hate how badly I think I do for the most part. Like, I am my own worst critic, and thus I am my own, I think, best motivator. I don't need someone to tell me any of those things. Oh, you're not doing this, this, and this. Because I actually welcome that. I welcome that criticism. It's more my own self. Like, I can't even figure out, like, how to be happy with something that I've done.
Other players in the Last Dance, Tyler Lockett, I see as Steve Kerr-ish. Is that just because he's small, though, and a deep passer? Is he more an integral role than Kerr was? He's probably got a more central role than Steve Kerr had. Although Kerr hit a pretty darn big shot. Hit a pretty darn big shot for that team.
That one's tough. I have Quandre Diggs as Steve Kerr right now. Because I look at him as a guy that they brought in the midst of this current group. And I feel like in big spots, he is fairly reliable, but are you looking at Quandre Diggs as one of the foundational pieces of the team? I think Tyler Lockett, you are. And that's why I'm not sure who I put as Scottie Pippen. I want to put Tyler Lockett as Scottie Pippen because I do think that, like, of all the Seahawks, he's probably the second best player in terms of what he's been able to do. And I know that people look at Bobby Wagner and would argue otherwise, but I think that Lockett has more of an impact in the 2020 NFL than Bobby Wagner. So, but at the same time, like, I also feel weird comparing anyone to Pippen because I hated Pippen in this documentary. I just could not stand him. And because of him quitting against the Knicks and the constant whining about his contract when he had signed it, like, voluntarily. So
who are you going to make Pippen?
For me.
Are you going to designate someone that you hate on this team?
I mean, do we just do it with someone who's gone? I mean, shoot. Like, it's hard because there isn't one player on this team that I look at right now and I say, man, I take an issue with him. Seriously.
It's Michael Bennett.
And the
one that's that Pippen asked out of a game, and that would have never been Michael's. Michael would have never asked out of the game. He just would have gotten into a fight with somebody at the end of the game. Like, he would have gotten into an unnecessary fight. So if you take the sort of, instead of sulking, he just starts swinging, would be it. But he constantly complained about his contract. Like, he's the guy that complained about his contract by far the most, because Marshawn Lynch is Rodman. So I could see Michael Bennett fitting into the Scottie Pippen contract complaining role. It got so, like, every year he just talked about how
goodness.
He was underpaid. You're like, dude, you just signed the contract. Why'd you sign the contract then? Why? Like, come on. You can't, like, 1 year into a 4-year deal, you can't complain about the contract. Like, you can't, like, it's ridiculous.
I do find that fascinating about sports. And we do tend to give players the benefit of the doubt in that situation. And it's funny, in retrospect, how much benefit of the doubt Pippen seems to have gotten generally from the people that watched this documentary compared to some of the players today, where we're like, dude, you just signed a contract. Like, that's what perhaps annoyed me the most. Because I've heard Scottie Pippen's actually, like, since leaving the NBA, he gets along great with people. I think that he's actually become fairly good as a TV analyst and stuff. And from, by all accounts, people at ESPN seem to really like him. But I keep on looking at just all of those moments, and I can't believe as many people that watched this documentary were so on his side, like, compared to Jerry Krause. Krause is an easy pincushion here, but, man, Krause did a pretty good job. And honestly, like, Pippen stunk after he left the Bulls. He was awful. Imagine if they had given him that contract extension and they'd stuck with him. Danny, he was terrible in Houston. He was absolute garbage.
Like, he didn't fit. He didn't fit on the team.
He stunk. He just wasn't good. Like, people in Houston will argue he mailed it in that season. And I, like, more so than Charles Barkley, who actually was out of shape in that season. So I don't know. For me, the hardest comparison to make was Scottie Pippen, because there isn't one player currently on this roster that I point at and I say, man, this guy just frustrates me every aspect about him. Maybe there could be someone like that down the road, but right now I couldn't think of it. It was a hard one, and it's weird because Scottie Pippen was clearly the second best player on the team. So if we're talking about just for play standpoint, it's got to be Tyler Lockett or DK Metcalf.
I think I found the team that I'm going to give the guarantee that they're overrated. The certified AAA Angus overrated stamp, because each year there's one that's overrated. Last year it was the Browns. I absolutely convinced before the season started they were overrated. I think I found this year's, and it's right in Seattle's division. We'll talk about that next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
They might be the trendiest team that pundits are picking in the NFC this coming season. And per one of their best players, who has been on that team for quite some time, this might be their best team ever. I'm talking about the Arizona Cardinals, and I'm talking about what cornerback Patrick Peterson had to say about the team earlier this week. Quote, "This is probably the best team I've ever been a part of on paper. What we've been able to add to the team this year, what the front office has been able to accomplish this offseason, being able to see guys and not being able to be around, it's been second to none." Now, Patrick Peterson's been with the Cardinals since 2011, and he was on that team in 2015 that went 13-3, won the NFC West, got a first-round bye, and made it to the NFC Championship game before being scalped by the Carolina Panthers. Danny, when you hear that from Patrick Peterson, what do you think?
Can you read it again? Can you read his quote again for me, please?
"This is probably the best team I've been a part of on paper."
That's pretty much what I think about that. The idea, there is nothing more hollow than off-season assessments of how long-tenured star player feels about his prospects. Like, it's not in any way indicative. Hey, who cares? Good. I'm glad he feels that way. You probably should, even if you think that your team stinks, you probably should still say that, right? Like, what are you really, is he going to say, "Hey, well, we'll be all right"? Like, the most honest thing is to say, "We'll see how it comes out." But, oh, I'm glad he feels that way. I think that this team is tremendously overhyped already. I think that their quarterback has a chance to be good in Kyler Murray. And I think he's in the right offense. I think that their coach can't control game situations. Like, the coach should not be in charge of the timeouts or the challenges, because so far he's shown himself to be fairly well over his skis when Cliff Kingsbury is asked to do any of those things. I like the player they picked, Isaiah Simmons, the kid out of Clemson that's the super fast linebacker whose actually physical prototype resembles pretty closely Bobby Wagner's. But I didn't think that defense was particularly good last year. I think that this is going to be one of these teams that's the trendy pick coming into the season and then completely stumbles coming out of the gate, much like Cleveland last year with all of the hype. Now, Cleveland had more hype than Arizona will have, but with the addition of DeAndre Hopkins and the expected development of Kyler Murray, I think there's going to be too much placed on this team too soon, and I think they'll flat out stink the first half of the season.
Stink. Interesting.
Yes.
Man, I think DeAndre Hopkins being added to this offense is actually being understated. That's how good the guy was. And, I mean, I covered the first how many years of his career? 2013 on? In Houston. That guy is quarterback proof. They could have a absolutely terrible quarterback back there like a Brock Osweiler, and that guy's going to produce. And maybe he's getting up there in age, but the Texans are evaluating him properly and trading him for a second-round pick. I feel like on their front, that's wishful thinking, and I think he is going to add so much confidence to an offense that I think needed some. There's a lot of young pieces, but how many of those young pieces do you feel like believe that they're one of the best players in the game? Kyler Murray doesn't. I don't think Christian Kirk failed that way. Kenyon Drake, I doubt, feels that way, even though he had a very good close this past season. They need to have somebody that has that edge, and Hopkins gives them that edge. I mean, Larry Fitzgerald probably doesn't even think that way anymore. I think it's going to be a huge boost in confidence for the Cardinals. So to come out the season beginning it flat, I suppose that's possible. But this is a team that you're going to have to be concerned about, I think, for the entirety of the year.
They allowed the most yards in the league last year. Like, their defense allowed the most yards in the league. And they gave up the fifth most points. They won five games. And I don't think one receiver, especially when you're talking about, I mean, being a second-year quarterback is still really tough. I was impressed with how Kyler Murray played last year, but when you're asking an awful lot from a second-year quarterback to incorporate a new receiver, even as good as Hopkins might be. We talk about the lack of offseason preparation. That's probably going to impact Arizona more than any. I mean, as much as we talk about it with Seattle's offensive line, you're talking about a quarterback getting used to a new wide receiver. I definitely have seen where adding a new receiver comes with the pressure to get that new receiver the ball, and it can disrupt, and you're not better despite having gotten a better receiver. I think Deion Branch is a terrible reference point, because I don't think he was ever going to be as good as the Seahawks pegged him to be when they traded a first-round pick for him. But he spent 3 years trying to watch the Seahawks get used to using Deion Branch, and it never really developed here. So I'm not of the opinion that it's a slam dunk there, and it doesn't do anything for their defensive side of the ball. It doesn't do it. I think Cliff Kingsbury's got a pretty good idea about what to do on offense. I don't think he has much of a clue how to manage close games. I didn't see anything from him last year that made me think that he, as a matter of fact, I think they'd be better off if they just let him call plays and had someone else manage the game, because I didn't think he did it well at all, like including the games where he was calling a timeout when his defense had made a stop. Before, remember that? And everybody's reacting like, what the hell are you doing? Well, I don't think he manages games very well. And that's just too much to put. There's too many people that are anointing the Cardinals as the team to take the next big leap.
I will admit that has shifted my own opinion a little bit. I hate it when everyone starts picking a team. I liked the Cardinals before they got DeAndre Hopkins, though. And I love the way that they finished the year. They were competitive basically in every single game the second half of the season, including the last four, one of which they beat the Seattle Seahawks with Brett Bleeping Hundley as quarterback.
That's true, but Paul, you just have to face it that you picked the trendy pick. You picked the team that's all of a sudden in heavy rotation
off my
on
horse.
MTV. Yeah, nope.
I will ride this horse.
I know you
we
think
ride.
That you were on it early, but nope. You are all part of the trendy. You are all part of the trendy. You are following the herd. You are following the crowd.
Nope.
You're one
I
of
led
many.
The herd. Led the herd, and I will be the hipster, obnoxious person that says, well, you know, I liked the Cardinals before they sold out. I was listening to their first albums when they were just playing in garages. I'm going to do that because I was first. Everyone else followed me, and then DeAndre Hopkins did too. It's Danny Engelwatz, 710 ESPN Seattle. He is Danny O'Neill, and I am a man by the name of Paul Maurice Gallant. Coming up next, it is very interesting to hear the way that Bruce Irvin envisions this coming 2020 season and his role on this Seahawks team. You'll hear what he had to say about that role yesterday and next right here on 710 ESPN Seattle.